Well, good morning again, and please take your Bibles and turn to Matthew 14. I want to say thank you. I didn't say it earlier, but it's encouraging to see so many people not letting small-numbered temperatures and penetrating snow in the face stop you from helping out our body warmth in this building, so I appreciate it. Praying that the Lord will take His passage today and encourage your hearts to trust Jesus more, as we were just singing. Let's begin by reading Matthew 14, starting in verse 22. Matthew 14, 22. Immediately, He made His disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side, while He dismissed the crowds. And after He had dismissed the crowds, He went up on the mountain by Himself to pray. When evening came, He was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, He came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw that He was walking on the sea, they were terrified, and they said, "It's a ghost!" And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered Him, "Lord, if it is You, command me to come to You on the water." And He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out His hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got in the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped Him, saying, "Truly, You are the Son of God." So far in the Gospel of Matthew, we have been in it for a couple years now. We've seen a lot of images of Jesus, a lot of pictures of Jesus displaying His true nature. Jesus has healed the sick, He has cleansed the leper, He has healed the Roman servant, or raised him from the dead, relieving a fever, stopping the wind, restoring a paralytic. He has stopped the desperate woman's bleeding that was going on for years. He raised a little girl from the dead. He opened the eyes of the blind. He made the mute speak. He healed a man with a withered hand. And last week we saw that He even fed the thousands, possibly up to 15, 20,000, with just five loaves or five hamburger buns, as we said, and two sardines. Jesus has overwhelmingly presented Himself to be Jesus, the Savior, the Messiah, the Lord. He is very God-man Himself, but still there are people who see Him and hear Him and don't believe He is who He says He is. And there are people who thought He was blasphemous. There were people who thought He was demonic. And sadly, even among His disciples, they still doubted exactly who He was at all times in their life. Jesus, being a perfect teacher, is going to do whatever it takes to drive this kind of doubt out of His disciples. With so much evidence already presented, you would think that the disciples would be where they're supposed to be. They would be fully convinced of what already has been shown to be true, but they're not. Again, you would think this would be a settled conviction, that no matter what happens in their life, they would know who Jesus is and not fear. But that's not the case. They still doubt. And rather than growing frustrated with the 12, Jesus continues to show His compassion. Rather than giving up on them, Jesus hones in on them and He gives them more attention. He commits to teaching them even more progressively than He was before. And the reason is because when it comes to His people, Jesus commits to serving them however they need it. Jesus will eventually and overwhelmingly convince all of His people He is who He says He is. He'll do it so much so that no one will ever doubt who He is again. And the same goes for you and me today. If you are one of His disciples in here this morning, you still have remaining doubts. Even if you don't know where they are, they're there. You're not glorified yet. And so Jesus is committed to serving you by strengthening your faith. Even with all the evidence you have in front of your face, even with all the passages that we get to read and all the testimonies we get to hear, even with all that we have, we still have remaining doubts as well. But Jesus is committed to not only removing those doubts, but strengthening our faith so that we learn to always and only trust Him. And that is what we're going to see in our passage this morning. Jesus wants the 12 to understand who He is in a better way. He wants to strengthen their faith. Again, like Christians today, they really do know Him, but they don't know Him like they should. which is the confession of every Christian. So Christ teaches them even more, and therefore we're going to see how Christ strengthens the faith of his disciples and how that even works to strengthen our faith today. So this morning, our outline is going to be very simple. I want to show you four ways that Jesus strengthens your faith. Number one, he does it as he arranges your circumstances, as he reveals your God, as he exposes your need, and as he compels your worship. This is what we'll see as we witness this familiar account of Jesus walking on water. So let's begin with the first one there. Jesus strengthens your faith as he arranges your circumstances. Look at verse 22 again. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. So like I said, last week we saw the feeding of the 5,000 men, Matthew says. We said that could potentially be anywhere from 15,000 to 20,000 people, somewhere around there. And while we saw the effect that had on the 12, the lessons they were supposed to learn, one thing we didn't talk about, because Matthew doesn't talk about it, is what was the crowd's response? How did the crowd respond to this feeding? In John 6:14, John says the crowd claimed that Jesus was the long-awaited prophet and king that they had wanted. And so they respond to this feeding by saying, "We're making this man a king." So immediately following this feeding and this response of wanting to make Jesus a king, Jesus makes his disciples get in a boat and dismisses the crowd, which, again, is not what you would expect to happen. Jesus comes as the king to be the king, and he finally gets a crowd to say, "Will you be our king?" And he says no and pushes them away and pushes his disciples away. The reason for this is because Jesus was dismissing himself and the disciples from what would have been an extremely tempting situation. To be presented with a crown without a cross would have been an appealing thing for these disciples. It would have been a temptation presented to Jesus. In fact, it's exactly what Satan was doing in chapter 4. Jesus being driven to the wilderness by the Spirit to be tempted by the devil presents to him an easy way to have kingdoms. But again, Jesus, who loves his Father, knows that's not his Father's will. It would have also been an appealing temptation to the 12 who've just gotten back from their first trip. They just got back from being rejected. Jesus has been talking about how much they're going to be rejected. You've got to, in comparison to your love for him, be devoted to him in such a way that you hate your own father and mother. You may lose your life. He's preaching all these hard things, and now this crowd says, "Let's just go ahead and make him king." Again, that would have been an extremely tempting thing for the disciples. But again, I don't want you to downplay Jesus' humanity. Jesus, being divine for all of eternity, never becoming God, did add humanity at a certain point in time. And so while it is impossible for him to submit his divine will because he shares it with the Father, he does submit his human will, and we can't overlook that. Jesus, in face of this temptation, submits his will to his Father because he knows that his Father is always good and to be trusted, and he loves him. Jesus, like us, is presented with opportunities to rebel, and we see him never, ever take those opportunities. So Jesus, according to his human nature, learns what kind of sufferings are his as the Messiah. He knows it'll be terrible, and here he hears the crowd saying, "Let's make you king," without that whole cross stuff, and he still turns away from it. And again, he loves his Father and loves to submit to him. Now, again, you may be asking, why is it that Jesus would turn the crowds away? And as I said, it's an odd thing. He came as the king. He came to be preached as the king. He came to present himself as the king. And you finally have a crowd saying, "Well, let's make him king." And he says, "No." But you got to remember, this crowd, as we saw last week, followed him around the sea. And they followed him as he came across because they liked what he was doing. They did not like him. It wasn't they loved Jesus. They loved what Jesus did. And so on top of that, at the end of that day, Jesus ends up feeding all of them. I mean, who wouldn't want this guy as a king? He's healing everybody. He's feeding all of us. But it was a fake love. It was a saccharine sweet love, if you will, that kind of thing. This was all they hoped for because they were hoping for the wrong thing. They didn't actually love the king himself. They loved the benefits the king was bringing. So Jesus wisely discerns through this. And makes, as Matthew says, makes his disciples get into the boat. He dismisses the crowd, and then he's by himself. Look at verse 23. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. And verse 13, last week we found out Jesus was going to be by himself. The crowd interrupts him. And then that whole story happens. And so now, finally, at the end of the day, he's by himself as he intended to. And he uses this opportunity to go to the Father in prayer. And you've got to stop and consider what that means for Jesus, but also for us. Jesus, in his humanity, as I said, knows the value of prayer. He knows that prayer is one of the main means that God uses to give his grace, if you will. Prayer is a means and therefore a priority of ours, like it was for Jesus. But as we know, we are not nearly as dedicated to prayer as he was. We see the importance of prayer in Jesus' life, and it forces us to admit the obvious. We neglect prayer, true, but always to our harm. Again, this is why we sing the old hymn, "Oh, what peace we often forfeit, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry," finish it for me, "everything to God in prayer." Jesus was familiar with that. He knew to go to the Father in prayer for every need of his, even as a human. Jesus knew this. He knew that he needed prayer. And that's why we see him praying so much. That's why we see him praying so long here. We'll explain it later. But he prayed for almost 9 hours here without any sins to confess on top of that. But Matthew in verse 24 draws our attention not to Jesus praying, but back to the disciples who did what they were supposed to and got in the boat. Verse 24 says, "But the boat by this time was a long way off from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them." So Matthew generically says it was a long way from the land, but John more helpfully puts in that it was about 3 miles off of the land. So here they are in the middle of a lake, and if you're not familiar with that, we say Sea of Galilee, kind of, you can picture lake, probably more helpful for us. If you're not familiar with it, you don't really understand what's the big deal about that. Who cares if they're 3 miles off the land? Again, you got to remember that morning, Jesus commanded the disciples to cross the lake for the first time, and that was about 5 miles, which, according to Middle Eastern averages at this time, it should have been about an hour. So that morning, they just took an hour journey to cross this lake. And now, at the end of the day, Jesus tells them to get back in the boat, and I'm sure they're wondering why and grumbling and complaining. Now, again, I'm imagining this, but I don't think I'm far off. You've got this trip across the sea. You got the crowds that they wanted to dismiss. Now Jesus feeds them, and they want to make Jesus king. And now Jesus is telling them no and telling disciples, get out of here. Say, but we just got here. Why are we going back across? Again, all these fishermen would have known exactly what Jesus was asking. You want us to get back in the boat after this pointless trip where this crowd wanted the right thing and you're saying no, and you want us to get back in the boat on the sea at night when we all know exactly what happens. Storms are popular at night. So again, I'm imagining here that they were grumbling and complaining, but it's not far off. It's easy to realize in the moment that you know better than Jesus when actually you don't. We all know this. The disciples are questioning Jesus about the crowd. The disciples are questioning Jesus about getting in the boat. And again, Jesus knows what he's doing, and this is part of what the point is here. As we read this, we know the end of the story, but if we were in the story with them, we would have struggled with these instructions. Again, it's easy for us to go, listen, disciples, just get in the boat, weather the storm, because Jesus is about to walk to you. We know the end, so it's easy for us to help them. But if you're in the boat and the waves are hitting you, you're not wanting to hear that. Again, we understand their confusion that was possibly there. We understand their confusion with the storm and things like that. But we know watching this how good this was that Jesus did this. It's when you're in the boat with them that you don't see that sometimes. So again, it's harder to tell ourselves that when we're in our storm, quote unquote, if you will. In the disciples' minds, they are being taken away from a crowd that wants the right thing and being sent into a storm needlessly. Again, this can't make any sense to them. And like they assume that obeying Jesus should mean smooth sailing, but like we learned in chapter 8 with the first storm at the sea, they obey Jesus and that actually sends them into a storm. Again, we need to learn what the disciples are learning here. Obeying Jesus does not mean removing yourself from storms or avoiding them. The disciples are here obeying Jesus in the middle of the lake, in the middle of a storm, and their boat is literally, Matthew says, being tortured. And these men's lives are in danger. And there's still one more detail that Matthew uses to paint this picture that you may overlook. Look at verse 25. "In the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea." The fourth watch of the night was the Roman way of referring to 3 to 6 a.m. Now, I want to lay this timeline out for you to paint this picture. They come to the place that morning. They have the crowds fed. Jesus feeds the crowds through them. The crowds want the right thing. Jesus says no, because he understands what's really going on. The disciples are having to be, verse 22 says, made to get in the boat. So I kind of picture this idea here of Jesus like grabbing a neck and like, you will get in the boat. Get away from the crowds, right? And here they are going out, and they're 3 miles out in the fourth hour of the night. Now, if our timetables are right, the crowds were dismissed somewhere around sunset. And now we're between 3 and 6 a.m. So from dark, from about 6 p.m. to 3 to 6 a.m., they've been rowing and they've made it 3 miles. This is the misery of the storm. This is what you detail you lack. They have been, in their mind, needlessly going back across the sea, and now they find themselves impossible to get across. After rowing for at least 9 hours, and I don't want you to miss that, it could have been up to 12. The journey that took them an hour that morning is now taking them 9 times, and they're only halfway. Again, I hope you start to understand what the disciples could have seen. Well, the reasons of Jesus not knowing what he's doing, opportunities to complain and impugn Christ's love and wisdom were plentiful. And again, here they are doing what Jesus told them to do, and they're miserable, and they are hopeless, and they are frustrated, they're exhausted, they're wet, they're cold, whatever descriptions you want to add. But we know from the passage that it's exactly where Jesus wants them to be. He has not messed anything up. He has not forgotten anything. He has not overlooked anything. We know, again, the end of the story. We know what's about to happen, but they don't see that yet. And again, this is the way that faith works. They're supposed to trust him, not knowing exactly what's supposed to be going on, but knowing what he said and that being enough. Again, when you're in the boat rowing and when you're in the boat getting hit by waves, it's a little different. This is the lesson that they're learning, but it's not one just for those disciples then. It's for disciples even today. To be convinced in a storm that Jesus still has your best interest in mind. To be convinced in a storm that he's still working all things out for your good. And again, we know from other passages, as we'll read too later, Jesus only takes you through trials and tests so that you'll know him better. So that faith is strengthened and endurance is cultivated. To know the trials and storms are God's way of growing you is really hard to hang on to when you're in the storm. That's why you have to fortify that thought while you're not in it. Again, this is what you have to remember. You'll never sail to spiritual maturity on a glassy sea. That is not Jesus' intention. That's not how it's going to happen. Give up hope of that. Again, like Christ, we would be tempted to get the crown without the cross, and we also are tempted to want to grow in our faith without tests, without trials, without pain. We want smooth sailing to godliness, if you will. But that is not how God designed for it to be produced. Again, Jesus, verse 22, made them get in the boat, not ignorant of what in the world's about to happen. Again, you see him praying, and again, it doesn't tell us what he prayed for, but I'm imagining he's praying regarding the temptations the crowd present. I'm also imagining he's praying for the lesson the disciples are about to get. He has orchestrated this event. He has arranged the circumstances for their good, even though it feels miserable in the moment. And again, Jesus always caring for them was something that they needed to be convinced of, and us as well. There is not 1 second of our eternity where Jesus is not working things out for our good. And again, that's a lesson that we cling to even in the storms. And so we see Jesus strengthening their faith as he arranges their circumstances. But secondly, he does it starting in verse 25 as he reveals your God. He doesn't just arrange your circumstances, but he reveals your God. Look at verse 25. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Like we said, they've been rowing now for about 9 hours, possibly up to 12. And here he is coming out to them, not running, panicking, not screaming. You know, what's going on? He sees what happens and can't believe this is going on. Jesus walks to them on the sea. And he descends the mountain, he walks out on the water. Let's not overlook that fact. He walks on the water, not in it, but on it, and he walks with a plan. Now again, Matthew doesn't tell us this here, but Mark 6:48 says this. Listen to what Mark 6:48 says. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and listen, he meant to pass by them. Now, I don't take that to mean Jesus meant to go around them. I mean, there's a lot easier ways to not be seen by them than walking on the water. It's going to be kind of obvious someone's walking on the water. So when it says he intended to pass by them, I take the understanding that this is a reference back to the passing by like God did to Moses in Exodus 33. If you'll recall in Exodus 33, Moses says, "Let me see your glory." And God says in Exodus 33, verse 20, "You cannot see my face, for man cannot see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there's a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft on the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I passed by." That phrase, "passed by," is linked to God revealing his glory. That seems to be the intention of this whole situation. Jesus puts them on the water in the storm to walk to them, to reveal his glory to them even more. And that is how faith is strengthened. Jesus knows their faith will never grow unless they get a more accurate glimpse of who he is. Jesus knows they need to not just see him with their physical eyeballs in their head, but again, like Ephesians 1 says, they need to grasp him with the eyes of their heart. Jesus knows that they need this, but not only does he know it, he gives it to them. He arranges and reveals all of these details to show his true identity to them. But look at verse 26, what happens at first. So they're in the storm. Jesus walks to them. You think, great, here he is. He just fed the thousands. What's he going to do for us now? That's not what happened. Verse 26, "But when the disciples saw him on the sea, they were terrified and said, 'It's a ghost.' And they cried out in fear." Again, remember, there's a raging storm happening. These men are not wimps. Some of them were professional fishermen. They knew exactly what was happening. This is a life-threatening storm where the journey that took them an hour just that morning, now halfway has taken them 9 to 12 hours. This is not a good place to be in. And so on top of the fears of that, they see this ghost-like creature walking on the water. Now again, we read this and go, why do they think Jesus was a ghost? So what would you think if somebody walked to you on the water? It's like, we expect Jesus to walk on the water because we read he walked on the water. If we didn't know he walked on the water, we would never expect him to walk on the water because people don't walk on the water. Ghosts, I guess we imagine, walk on the water, but humans don't walk on the water. And so here they are in this terrible storm, greatly afraid of the storm, and then an even greater fear grasped them. The sea was often featured with dark spirits, things like that, death. And so it seems like when they see this spirit, what they thought was a spirit, coming to them, they just assume, this is our time. Death has come for us. They scream, here's a ghost, and they think their life is over. But again, I want you to notice their fear was real, but it was rooted in the wrong conclusion. The reason they began to fear is because they thought the wrong thing. Again, if they could fix their thinking, if they lived according to reality, their feelings would have been far different. Now again, we rightly see this, and we know they're wrong to feel this way, but again, we are blind to it when the waves are hitting us, when the storm's hitting us. When your theology is either bad or forgotten, you too will make wrong conclusions about life, and you will have feelings and emotions that aren't good. You will have responses to that wrong reality that you're living in. Again, when you see a terrible situation and make wrong conclusions, you'll be crippled with the fear that it brings. What those disciples needed was for somebody to clarify who this was on the water. That's exactly what Jesus does. Jesus speaks truth to them. They are not living according to reality. He is not a ghost. Their life is not over. And they need Jesus to clarify what's going on. So he does in verse 27. Look. "But immediately Jesus spoke to them and he said," notice three things he says, "take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." So Jesus immediately seeks to comfort his disciples, not to respond immediately by casting doubt on are they really his disciples, not by rehashing all the ways they failed before and you're doing this again now. He immediately seeks to comfort them with three statements. And I want to help you. The first and the third are rooted in the middle. Okay, let me explain what I mean. You kind of have a early picture of put off, put on. Jesus comes to them and says, take heart, do that. Don't fear, don't do that. Do take heart, don't take fear. And in the middle, we get the reason. Why is it that in this storm, these disciples could take heart and not fear? Because as he says in the middle, it is I, or more helpfully, I am. This is the Greek pairing of ego a me, which is what John records over and over again. I am, I am, I am. This is what Jesus says here to them on the storm. It's the clearest way that Jesus can bluntly refer to God's name, Yahweh, as his own name. Again, as I said, Jesus reveals himself to them, and in this, he reveals their God to them. He is their God. Again, this is what he was sent to do, and it's exactly what he's doing. Even if no one on earth perceives it, even if everyone stays blind, he's still doing it. And again, as unbelievers, eyesight is not the best attribute you have. The New Testament compares you to a blind person. When God's glory shines, you are blind and you don't see it. But what we're seeing in this passage is even as believers, even as true disciples, we still get blurry vision sometimes. I know Christ is glorious, but I don't see how glorious yet. And so here's Jesus coming to his disciples to even raise their view of him even more. So Jesus helps them and us by revealing his glory on this sea in the middle of the storm. And seeing that he is the I am gives them reason to be able to take heart and not fear. Again, we have hope because Jesus is the I am. How miserable it would be to have a God who was or will be, or just hang on a minute, I'll get to it, that kind of God. To have a God who was the used to be would be eternally miserable. To have a God who changes or is undependable. What you have is the eternal I am. That is God, and that is Jesus. The one who is eternally trustworthy, sovereign, who alone can orchestrate everything for his glory and your good, and the one who alone can keep all of his promises, because there's nothing he doesn't know. There's nothing that overpowers him. There's nothing he pulls back on and lies about. Again, your flesh and your faith will fail, but your Lord won't. Christ knows all things. He controls all things. And he always works them out for your good. Even when you don't know how he's going to do it, even when you don't know when he's going to do it, you can still know that he's going to do it. That is the lesson that we're getting here on the water. Again, you can count on all of Christ's promises because he is the I am. You can take heart. You cannot fear because he is the I am. Again, this is what those on the water were seeing and hearing. Jesus strengthening their faith as he arranges their circumstances, very intentionally, obviously, and as he reveals their God. But thirdly, he strengthens their faith by exposing their need. Look at verse 28. Jesus strengthens your faith by exposing your need. Verse 28. Before we read it, I want to make sure you get the picture. Here they are in the boat. Jesus just clarifies who he is. And then Peter responds. Verse 28. Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." Now, again, just to help Peter out, because Peter gets a bad rep, I get it, but Peter's usually the most active one. He's usually the first one to speak, and when you do that, you're probably going to say some things that people can critique. And this is not a downfall of Peter, I don't think. Peter is not wondering if it still is Jesus. When he says, "if it is you," it is the way that we use "if" like since. Like if I said to Danae, "hey, I'm going to go to the store later," and a little later she says, "hey, if you're going to the store, so-and-so." Now she's not telling me I'm a liar. Like, "you said you're going to the store, so if you go to the store," that's not what she's saying. She's saying, "since you're going to the store, can you pick up so-and-so?" This is the way Peter's using it here. Peter hears Jesus say who he is. He hears him identify himself as the I am. And Peter says, "since it's you, call me out to come to you." It seems like Peter is more comfortable walking to Jesus on the stormy sea than being in the boat. And so he tells Jesus to call me to yourself. He's not being presumptuous. He doesn't just start walking on the water and say, "hey, pick up the slack wherever you see I need it." He tells Jesus, "command me to come to you." Although this is an impossible thing to do, if you command me to do it, I know you'll empower me to do it. That's what they just saw in the feeding. Remember, Jesus told the disciples, "feed the crowd," and they say, "we can't do this. It could be 8 months' salary we spend. We still wouldn't feed this crowd." And yet Jesus does provide for the crowd through the disciples. Here you see Peter saying, "tell me to walk on water." I would imagine, again, imagining all 11 were going, "what are you talking about? Walk on the water." Again, but Peter knows if Jesus commands it, he provides the ability to do it. Look at verse 29. He said, "come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Now again, I know this runs the risk of being a cheesy bumper sticker, which just is like nails on a chalkboard to me. But this literally is a step of faith, okay? He is literally walking on water by faith. That's what's going on here. When Jesus says, "come to me," because Peter knows who's talking, he understands what he says, he does it no matter what in the world everyone else thinks. Again, you got to remember, we sometimes want to investigate everything so much that, "Jesus, your commands better make sense before I obey them." What evidence would there have been that walking on water would have been a good idea? No one ever done it before, except Jesus, and he's doing it right now, but Jesus is not just like a normal human in the sense of he's also God. So while he has real humanity, he also has real divinity. And so for them to look around and look at, you know, world history, to look at science, to look at all these things, to think, okay, what evidence is there that Jesus' command to walk on water is a good command? There's none. But Peter does it because he knows who Jesus is. He trusts Jesus. He steps by faith, if you will. He walks by faith. Just like Jesus told them to feed the crowds and they did it, Peter says, if you tell me to walk on water, I must be able to do it by your power, obviously. And so he does it. But again, Jesus is doing all this to nurture their faith and strengthen them. So Peter exercises real faith. Now, I want you to understand that. He exercises existing real faith. Peter's not an unbeliever. And he actually steps on the water. But that's where his stepping, if you will, revealed that he had room to grow. Peter's faith is real. He actually listens and steps on the water. He actually walks on the water. But as we see in verse 30, Peter's faith was not perfect. Look at verse 30. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Now I read that, Lord, save me. I'll explain in a minute. It probably was, Lord, save me, like that. He was drowning, and I'll explain what I mean in a second. Just like the disciples' obedience didn't take them away from the storm, Peter's obedience wasn't taking him out of the storm. Jesus called Peter to walk on the water while it was still storming. Now, you know as well as I do that Jesus could have easily calmed the storm and said, now get out the boat and walk to me. That would have made it a little easier, it seems like. Jesus could have waited till Peter's foot touches the water, and now seeing that Peter really does believe him, okay, now I'll clear the storm and you keep walking to me. That's not what he does. Jesus intends for Peter to not only walk on the water in the storm, but he intends for him to keep walking on the water during the storm. Again, how encouraging it could have been to go other ways, but that's our own way of thinking. That's our own wisdom. That's listening to ourselves. That's Proverbs 3, leaning on our own understanding. Jesus has better plans. Peter's obedience required him to walk on the water in the midst of the storm, and it's there that Jesus graciously and kindly reveals to him that his faith is little. Peter let the things that surrounded him distract him, not only looking away from Christ, but fearing them more than he feared Christ who was standing in front of him. Now again, I want to be helpful here and clear. It's not that the waves weren't that bad. There are people who believe that in particularly bad storms, the waves on this little sea could get up to 10 feet. This is not saying, trust Jesus because things aren't really that bad. No, things are bad. That's not the point. We're not called to trust Jesus because things aren't like they seem. We're called to trust Jesus even though things are what they seem. Even though the storm was bad, even though their life felt in danger, he's still called to trust Jesus in the middle of all that. Again, our sovereign God does all that he pleases. He is our good shepherd and our Lord. There is nothing that will ever change his plans. And so in the storm, to doubt that is to impugn him in one sense, is to give offense. And we typically forget this. When someone goes through a hard time, and I understand this, we need to be empathetic, we need to be compassionate, I get this. But we'll usually justify doubt and go, hey, it was a hard time, I get it. And I do. We're all frail. We all fail. I get that. We are not glorified yet. But none of us should ever lose the sting of the indictment that a lack of faith says. Imagine, if you will, when you're kids, you're in the pool, your kid's on the side, you say, hey, jump to me. And they say, no. Why not? Well, I'm afraid. But I'm going to catch you. But I'm afraid. Well, the reason you're afraid is because you don't really believe I'm going to catch you. I mean, that's the indictment here. The reason I'm not doing what you said is because I really don't trust you. Again, this is the indictment that we have every time we sin, every time we doubt, every time we cling to our own understanding over God. Look, God, I know what you've promised me, and I know that it's true, but I'm not sure about right now. Again, I'm not sure at least well enough to listen. So again, when things tempt you to take your focus off of Christ, to let go of his promises, you've got to remember to keep your focus on him, but Peter doesn't do that. Again, he looks away from Christ and looks at what's threatening him. And then it says he begins to sink in Matthew here. The word for begins to sink is the word drown, okay? It's not begins to sink. And in my mind, I always pictured it like quicksand, like slowly. You know, he begins to sink, but if he can believe a little harder, he'll kind of come up a little. And that's just what I picture. My head's not always a great place to be, right? But in Matthew 18:6, the same word is used of the one who has the millstone tied around his neck, and the word says he drowned. Okay? That word for drown. Peter, the moment he takes his eyes off of Christ onto the waves, starts to drown. And so he doesn't have time for this delicate, intricate, great prayer. He screams out, "Lord, save me." So again, you have Jesus here who's been faithfully praying to the Father for 9 hours, and he remains faithful. And you have Peter, who can't even make it across the sea without doubting Jesus. He doubts Jesus and has time for this puny little prayer, "Lord, save me." But here's the thing, it's heard. Again, we're comforted in seeing a picture like this because it reminds us that we are not saved by the greatness of our prayers. We're not saved by the greatness of what we do and plead for. We are saved by the greatness of our Christ. And so Peter here, with Jesus right in front of him, doubts Jesus and starts to drown. And even though he's drowning, even though his prayer is puny, Jesus responds and hears him and saves him. Jesus doesn't let him drown just a little, let his lungs fill up with a little bit of water. I'll get that out later, and I'll make him feel a little bit of the pain of what it feels like to doubt me. That's not what Jesus does. He doesn't say, "No, Peter, you doubted me, you get what you deserve." No, Peter says, "Lord, save me." And so Jesus does. Verse 31, look at it. Jesus immediately, there's that word again, reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Again, the key word being immediately. Jesus has no animosity towards Peter. He has no bitterness. There's no hesitancy to show kindness to Peter, even though he's in the mess he created. Again, Christ's infinite compassion and grace and mercy are on clear display here. And this is the same exact thing Christ does for everyone who truly calls on him. Again, you can know that your life is miserable. You can know that it's your fault your life is miserable. But again, we see here, no matter the mess we're in, we call to Christ immediately. He reaches out to rescue us. Again, we're not used to this kind of treatment. This is why we doubt Christ sometimes. Because if there's anybody else in my life I betrayed as much as I've betrayed Christ, if there's anybody in my life I doubted as much as I've doubted Christ, they would have nothing to do with me. If I come back to them for the 500th time and say, "I'm sorry, please forgive me," I might get a little grunt or a little sigh at least, right? Again, that's not what Christ does. If we abandoned and betrayed people in our own life the way we have Christ, they would be hesitant, if willing at all, to still help us. But we see here a willingness for Christ to help us, even in our own mess, time and time again. Jesus has promised to never leave or forsake us. He promised to finish what he starts. And he promises to hang on when our grip slips. I was thinking about this earlier. When we're at some theme park or in somewhere where I got to hold on to a kid's hand, I take my 3-year-old, for example. The way that I typically hold their hand is he'll grab my finger and I'll grab his hand. It's kind of the way that I do it. I have large fingers, larger than his hand, right? So he'll grab my finger, I'll grab his hand. And there are distractions that happen. So maybe there's a snack or something he wants to run over there and get. So he'll let go, but I don't. Or maybe he falls. And as he's falling, I'm able to pick him up. So he loosens his grip, but I don't. And so you can say he's holding on to me, but I'm holding on to him as well. And whereas his grip might slip, mine's not. Now, it might in reality, but for illustration purposes, bear with me. This is the way that I picture this idea of Christ holding on to us. As believers, we do truly hold on to him. That is something we do. But we also know that we're prone to wander. We're prone to fall. We're prone to have our grip loosened because waves are crashing on us. And we have promises in God's word that he will never let us go. That's what we see here. Peter's unfaithfulness serves us to highlight Christ's faithfulness. Peter's taking his eyes off of Christ emphasizes Christ's never taking his eyes off of Peter. Peter's quickness to look away is overshadowed by Christ's endurance to look at him. Again, Peter's drowning is ended by Christ's readiness to save him and save Peter from the mess he's made. And then Jesus picks him up and says to him, "Look again, oh you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Jesus roots Peter's drowning in his doubting, and he roots his doubting in little faith, which little faith is a phrase that has kind of been a mystery to me. You think little faith, or I think little faith. Again, you're getting previews of what goes on inside my head. When I think little faith, I think, okay, the opposite's big faith, right? So how do you want little faith to become big faith? Well, like strain harder, or I don't know how to make little faith bigger. Well, you make it grow, but how does it grow? And this whole word picture has been a little bit of a mystery. But again, as I was studying it this week, I was helped out by looking at the word itself. The phrase in English, "Oh, you of little faith," is actually one word in Greek. And it's the word faith with the word short thrown on the front of it. So literally, Jesus is saying short faith. That helps me a lot more. Let me explain. When I think of little faith, I think size-wise. But here, Jesus seems to be emphasizing short faith, meaning it didn't endure. You had faith, and then you let it go. Like the finger analogy here. You held my finger, and then you let my finger go. Little faith is genuine faith. You don't see Jesus rebuking Peter as an unbeliever. Jesus is not saying, why don't you come to faith for the first time in me? But he is saying that little faith means short faith, faith that doesn't endure like it's supposed to, faith that doesn't last as long as it's supposed to. That truth that you cling to, you're letting go too quickly. And so while we are saved by faith alone, not great faith alone, but faith alone, we do, as believers, have a constant need for our faith to grow. And by grow, I mean be lengthened, strengthened, endured, if you will. We need to be more grounded in who Christ is and what he's promised us so that when our trials come, they work to lengthen the amount of time that we cling to who Christ is. Again, this is why tests are necessary. Romans 5:3, we rejoice in our sufferings knowing, notice, he doesn't say we rejoice in sufferings because sufferings are just awesome. He doesn't say we rejoice in sufferings feeling. He says we rejoice in sufferings knowing that suffering produces endurance. James 1, 2, and 3, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. So as a believer, I can have real faith, genuine faith, that is not enduring like it's supposed to, that is not steadfast like it's supposed to, and because of that, Jesus sends trials and temptations my way, or trials and tests, if you will. They produce the steadfastness and endurance that we naturally lack. They are God's way of helping us take little faith and lengthen it, so that when those waves come, if you will, we don't look away from Christ so quickly. This is the point that they have in our life. For instance, you have little faith if you're willing to get into a debate about God's sovereignty and salvation, and then the bills come and you panic because you don't know how in the world God's going to take care of you. It's like, why do you cling so tightly to that truth over here, but then when you're confronted with this problem, you let it go? Again, you're experiencing what little faith is when you sing songs about Jesus' care for you, and then you leave church, you hear the news that the world sounds like it's crashing. Oh no, I'm going to live in fear now. Again, it's truth that you cling to, but then when you're confronted with something else, you let it go to grasp what's taken hold of your fear. Again, Jesus won't leave us in this position. Jesus loves us and serves us by strengthening our faith and encouraging us along the way until he's glorified us. And that means for your faith that you will never, there's a day coming where you're glorified and you'll never ever doubt Jesus again. You'll never ever have anything come in where you wonder if Jesus tells the truth, or you'll wonder should you obey here. That day is coming. That day is not today. We are working, being worked on towards that day. This is what Christ is doing in our life through trials. This is why he exposes our need for endurance, because he is helping us. So again, Peter would have never asked to begin drowning, but Peter was more desperate for Christ drowning than he was even on the water. Again, Christ was more desirous for Peter as he's drowning in the water than when he was walking on it. And so Christ serves Peter and us in caring for us by nourishing our faith. He does it as he arranges your circumstances and reveals your God, exposes your need. Lastly, he compels your worship. Look at verse 32. He compels your worship. And when they got in the boat, the wind ceased. So just progressing the story here, Jesus picks Peter up, which it seems like Peter got pretty close to Jesus if he just reached out and grabbed him. So Peter is grabbed by Jesus. They get in the boat together. And as soon as he does, the storm stops. So Christ's glory being on display and who he says he is, what he shows them he's doing, walking on water, and even in the fact that the wind and waves stop, this helps prove the verse 27, I am. His display as God is on clear presentation. The disciples get a little bit better understanding now of who Jesus is. Obviously, they knew who Jesus was to some degree. They believed in him to some degree. But their faith had a lot of learning and growing to do. They are growing and they are learning from these kind of lessons. And we see that because at the end of chapter 8, when the storm settled, do you remember what the disciples said about Jesus? The storm ceased, and they marveled at each other and said, what kind of man is this? Well, they don't do that here. Look at verse 33. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. These disciples are learning. Christ, being a good teacher, is teaching us for our good. And these disciples are better off right now than they were before they went through that storm. Again, the most recent lesson they're learning involves the life-threatening storm as a means of teaching them. And they would have never volunteered to go through it. But I guarantee you, they would agree with Psalm 119:71, it was good for me that I was afflicted. They wouldn't trade this for the world. What they saw about Christ, what they learned about Christ going through this storm, was worth the storm. Again, it's not that affliction is good in and of itself, but it's part of God's good and wise plan to let us know him the way that we're supposed to cause us to know him and grow. Again, the storm was what God used to give them a clearer picture of himself and to pull out of them more natural worship. When you're convinced who God is, when they're convinced who Jesus was in the boat with him, it naturally overflowed in worship, which is the end. Worship is not the means to something else that's better. Worship is the end that God is getting us all to. And again, I don't want you to misunderstand as though the disciples have no room left to grow. We will see them fail again. We'll see Peter do things like deny Christ three times. But I do want you to understand the real faith that was there is strengthened now even more, and it will continue to be so. As their faith grows, so does their worship. And so the lesson from feeding the 5,000 men taught them that Christ can provide for them no matter what he commands them to do. But here you see them forget to apply that even in the storm. And so Jesus enters them into the storm where they doubt him, especially Peter. They find out their faith is short. It doesn't persevere. They're too quick to let go or look away. And so now after going through this, the truth that they already believed is more ingrained in them. And so again, they worship another man. And that's unthinkable if you're in their boat, if you will. It's unacceptable for you to worship any other man. We see in the book of Revelation, when an angel is worshiped, he says, get up, don't do that to me. We see when Paul's worshiped in Acts, don't do that to me. But then we see when Jesus is worshiped, it's a right thing to do because he's not just a man, he's the God-man. They're starting to behold who Christ is a little bit better. They've seen things with their eyeballs, they've heard things with their ears, and their hearts are starting to grasp a little bit better who Jesus is. Which again, is exactly what happens to us in our sanctification. By God's grace, stories like this help reveal who Jesus is to a greater degree. I read things like this and I learn more about Jesus, not just he walked on water, but the implications of that. The comfort we see in the way he treats Peter and his disciples, the way he orchestrates all things, and the result of that is, like them, more worship for Christ. This is how Jesus strengthens your faith. This is what the lessons are for. This is, again, the point of the lesson. I jokingly called, last week's seminary banquet, this week's seminary cruise. This is the point of the seminary, to worship Jesus, to love him and be so convinced he is who he is from your heart that you don't doubt him, and rather than doubting him, you worship him. This is the point of your life, to know and trust and love and worship our God as revealed in his Son, Jesus Christ. That's what believing Matthew 14 about the walking on the water leads you to. That's why we cling to Jesus tighter and longer, because we're seeing more of his glory. Again, in the face of temptations and doubts, we trust him to do exactly what he promised. Again, this leads us to greater worship, as we see in the passage. So again, I mentioned this earlier, but even if you're the most spiritually blind person in this room, you read a passage like this, you are being confronted with the fact that Jesus stands there ready to receive Peter the moment he cries out. Again, what greater news could you have than Jesus, whom you've made an enemy, the one that you've rebelled against, impugned, and said you're not worth trusting, still stands there ready to receive everyone who calls out to him. And again, you are in a mess. I understand that. It may even be a mess that you made yourself, but like Peter, we don't have to remain in that. Jesus puts himself on display last week with the feeding and this week with the disciples as one who's full of compassion. This is the best promise you have ever heard. I can guarantee you that. That the mess you find yourself in with your sin and your misery, your sorrow, your hopelessness, that Christ stands there ready to receive you the moment you call out to him. And how much more precious is that promise to those who already believe it to some degree. But we read this and we go, I've got so much further to go. There are so many things that come on you in life. There's so many things that hit you through the week. There's so many things you think in your head. And it attacks you and it tells you to look away from Christ. yeah, he can be trusted over here with all that Bible stuff, but don't trust him with this work stuff. You can trust him with your salvation, but don't trust him with this family stuff. Again, what more encouragement could you receive than what we see here? No matter how many times you have sinned, no matter how many times you've doubted him, he is committed to his people to be ready and to immediately pick you up every single time because you need him to do that. And again, unlike the people we know in our life, he never tires of doing this. He never hesitates. He never grumbles in rescuing you again from the same mess he just pulled you out of. Again, how could our hearts not respond with anything else but worship? To know Christ, to trust him, to love him, and like they do in the boat, to worship him. Let's do that now as we pray and close in our song.